We're about to jump in. When I discussed with Rabbi Kelman the plan for this course in Kohelet, it was before October 7th, and the world looked very different. We are committed to seeing this through and to the end of the Sefer without question. I'll tell you that every time I go through chapter by chapter, and there are pieces of it, and in the context of today's world, I realize that Kohelet is a hard sefer to learn at this time, particularly because not only because of its very depressing and kind of a pessimistic mood, but also because he pulls in references and imagery and subjects and context that in today's world, we right now post October 7th with Israel at war, it's not the I wouldn't be necessarily choosing to talk about these things and to put them on the agenda, and not even in terms of imagery for whatever subject we were particularly discussing. However, we
I
are
just
happy.
must tell you that I found usually until October 7th, I thought that the Pilegesh Begiva was a horrible story.
Well, Pilegesh Begiva is a horrible story.
No, I think the Hamas beat him.
Oh yeah, well that's a separate issue. But there's a lot to be said for what we learn at various times. But we're here, we're studying Kohelet, and we're not going to change course in the middle because we won't be able to go back to it at any particular time. And so as best we can, we're going to try to pull ourselves out of the world around us and immerse ourselves in the subject at hand and try to do the best we can. And if references, nuances, subject matter, imagery of any kind within the context of the Sefer finds that it resonates in today's world right now in our emotional state of being in a way which is perhaps more uncomfortable than it would be in any other context, the best I can do is to apologize, but there really isn't a choice because Kohelet is what it is. It's a sefer in Tanakh. We have no choice but to, as they say in the Gemara, Torah hi v'lumod ani tzarich. It is Torah. It is part of Tanakh. We need to study it, that's part of our resilience is that life goes on and we continue our course of study. So I appreciate your tolerating my little segue introduction. That's the source page for today if anybody needs it. And I'm going to share my screen and we're going to jump right in. If you have a video that can be turned on, it will be helpful to me because I will see you all on the second screen as soon as I share my first one with you. And I will continue to see your faces throughout the shiur today. We are going to actually a couple of things I need to do first. We are recording, and I need to go spotlight. So I will go spotlight, which will make my screen very big for everybody. You can go back to gallery view to shrink me back down to size. And we're going to jump into second before I go there. Make sure I have. Okay. Let's share screen. Oh, that's not good. One second. Okay, I'm not sure why that did that. Okay, we'll have to fix it this way. Okay, well, my Zoom went and did something funny, but we'll figure it out. Okay, we are in the middle of Perek Hey, if I remember our discussion. The last thing we did was the before the break. I apologize. A break is unfortunately a necessary thing in these worlds. Kohelet, last thing we did was the Yirei Elokim, and his final message of the Yirei Elokim was to address the core of the issue, which was the sense of the necessity of the Amal to build and to create and to achieve and to see results from his achievement. And so he turns to the Amal and he says, "Metukashnat ha'oved, turn your concept of amelut, of toil for a purpose, into a sense of avoda, of work for the sake of work, meaning as part of a process, whether little or whether big, and you'll sleep well at night. Metukashnat ha'oved. Because if your goal is sova, if your goal is wealth, then you'll never sleep well at night because ultimately you're driven by the sense of need of accomplishment. Whereas the Oved is satisfied with, the Oved Hashem especially, is satisfied with the sense of doing his share and partnering with God to complete the process. That was more or less where we left off with the Yirei Elokim. We spent a good number of classes on the Yirei Elokim. And we're going to move now into the latter half of Parak Hay. Our goal for today and for next week is to complete the next unit, which is the Amal. And I'll show you why I'm already sharing that information with you in advance. We're going to start with Pasuk Bet. Yesh ra'acholah ra'iti tachat ha'shamash. There is a sickening evil, a grievous evil that I have seen under the sun. Osher shamur leva'alav lera'ato. Wealth preserved for its owner to his own detriment, to his own harm. Osher, it's saved, it's preserved, shamur, and then it gets lost. Osher, some misfortune. Bolid ben, and then he has a son. Ve'em b'yadom u'ma. And he has nothing to provide to his son. Kashi yatzah mibetanimo arom yashuv lalechet kishabah. As he, the father, the one who toiled and lost all of his fortune, emerged from his mother's womb, naked shall he return as he came. Umeuma lo yisa ba'amalo shiyalech biyado. And take nothing for his labor which he may carry. And this is a terrible evil. Kolumat Shabbat, can you lech? He goes as he came. What gain, what profit does he have for all of his toil in the wind? Gam all his days he eats in darkness, v'ka'as harbei, and he's very angry, and he suffers sickness, v'ketzef, and anger and wrath. For what? What does it get him? Hinei asher ra'iti ani. I'm going to read through the whole unit, and then we're going to go back and do this piece by piece. There are essentially four sections to this speech, and we're going to break them down. Hinei asher ra'iti ani, tov ashiyafel le'echol v'lishtot, v'lirot tova b'chol amalo she'amol tachat hashemesh mispar yemei chayav v'shenatano elokim ki hu chalko. Behold, that which I have seen is good, tov, to eat and to drink and to enjoy all of the good and all of the toil which one has toiled under the sun, the number of days that God has given him, but that is his portion. Gam kol adam shenatan lo elokim osher nechasim v'yishlito lechom memenu. If God has enabled one to have riches and wealth and to give him the power to rule over it, v'laset et chokoh, and to enjoy his portion, v'lismach ma'amalo, zo matat elokimi, that is indeed a gift from God. Ki lo harbe yizkor et yimei chayav, ki elokim ma'aneh b'simchat libo. You shall not often reflect. Translation here is hard to process, but he shall not often or for long. He shall not reflect on his days. God either occupies him with joy of his heart or challenges him with joy of his heart. It's unclear exactly what, how to translate that. I'm moving on into chapter 6. We'll see why in a moment. There is an evil I have seen under the sun, and it is heavy on man. Man to whom God gives riches and wealth and honor, but and lacks nothing for him in all that he desires, but God does not give him the power to eat it, to enjoy it. It will all be enjoyed and taken by a foreigner, a stranger. This is vanity and evil. A person can father 100 children and live for many years. Many years, days are his, and many years are his life. And his soul is not filled with the good. Does not even have burial. I say that a stillborn is better than he. But the stillborn comes in darkness and leaves in darkness. And his name is covered in darkness. Gam shemesh lo ra'a, he never saw the sun. V'lo yada, never knew the sun. Nachat l'zeh mizeh, that one has more rest than this one who toils under the sun for naught. V'ilu chaya 1,000 shanim p'amayim, v'tova lo ra'a, could live 1,000 years twice. And fails to enjoy the good that he has accomplished. Halo al makom echad kol alech, all goes to one place. Kol amal adam lefiu v'kam nefesh latimalei, all the labor of man is for his mouth, and yet the appetite is never satiated. Kimayotel lechacham min aksil, what advantage has the wise over the fool? Me'el ani yodel aloch neged achayim, what does the poor man know to walk before the living? Tov mareinayim alach nefesh, it is better to see the sight of the eyes than the wandering of desire. Gam ze hevel lutruach, this is vanity, and chasing wind, it's also unintelligible. So I'm not quite sure what to do with that, but that we'll have to figure that one out. Ma she'aya kvar nikra shemo, what has been given a name long ago, v'noda asher hu adam, and it is known what man is, v'lo yuchal ladinim shetakiv mimenu, he cannot contend with whom he who is mightier than he, ki yesh v'nim harbe maravim havo, for there are many words that create vanity, mayotel adam, what profit does man have, ki mi yodea matov l'adam b'chayim ispaye mechaye avlo v'yasem ketzel, for who knows what is good for a man's life, all the days of his vain life which he spends like a shadow, who can tell a man what will be after him under the sun? These last four psukim from Pasuk Tet to the end really are almost unintelligible. We'll deal with them at a separate time. But there's a lot of pieces here, and there's a lot of vexing, and there's a lot of ra'ah, there's a lot of evil, there's a lot of hevel, there's a lot of under the sun, there's a lot of toiling to the wind, a lot of different pieces of the story. And so to make some kind of sense of what's going on, we need to take a step back, and as we've done many times, look at the whole picture, the whole bird's eye picture of who's speaking and what is themes are they addressing. And in order to do that, especially because it spans two chapters, I have pulled this translation and this text into a single page. And that's on the source page that I shared with you a few moments ago. For anybody who didn't get it, we'll just do a quick paste. Actually, let me see if I can do that again. Quick paste. If anybody didn't get it, you can pull it up now. But I'm going to put it on the screen for you all. It's very small print right now. I'm going to zoom in a second, but I want you to see the whole picture. Okay? So I'll zoom in and we'll do it line by line, but I just want you to see the picture. So starting with chapter 5, verse 12. Yesh ra'a chola ra'iti tachat ha-shamash. There is a grievous evil that I have seen under the sun. Chapter 6 begins, Yesh ra'a asher ra'iti tachat ha-shamash. There is an evil which I have seen under the sun. So there is a similar beginning to each of these two chapters, which tells me that on some level they are connected. And that's a very important piece because we're going to see them as one structured message or speech. On the other hand, Pasuk Yud Zayin, which I've indented slightly, begins, Hinei Asher Ra'iti Ani Tov. Something's good in this world. Well, if something's good and that contrasts to something evil, so then either we're in a different speech, meaning a different persona speaking, responding, or what I believe in this case is it's the same speaker, but there's an evil and it's a possible solution. It's a possible something positive that we can address. And so we'll have to see. We're going to look at this section here in the context of a problem and a possible solution. Okay. Then he has a new problem, which may be related to the solution we've just offered. Yeshua Asher Iti Tachat HaShemesh. And that will lead him to the end of this to this section. So, who is speaking, and what evidence do we have that that is the case? So, before we go any further, let me go back to Perek Vav in the text. This is the Mekor Gedolot online that I use. Let me go back to chapter 6, and let me just move a little bit into chapter 7, so that you can understand why this, I believe, is the end of a unit. If I move to the next chapter just for a moment, two things emerge. First, Perek Zayin, Pasuk Aleph begins, Tov Shem Yishemen Tov. I'm not even going to translate. I just want you to hear it. Okay? There's only one word I want you to hear, so I'm not even going to translate. Tov Shem Yishemen Tov, Yom HaMavet Yom HaBaldo. Tov Lelecha Dabet Deva Milecha Dabet Mishteh Bashu Sof Kol Adam B'chayit Tenet Libo. Tov Kas Mischok Kibra Panim Yitav Lev. Tov lishmor gavat chacham. Tov achavit tevah mereishito. Tov achochmaim nachala. Okay? That clear enough? Chapter 7 is a completely different subject, a different style. Suddenly everything is good. Suddenly everything is positive. Who is speaking? What is he saying? Why is he saying it? We'll get to that's piece number one that indicates that that's already a new unit. Piece number two is I want you to take a look at this letter. First letter of the first pasuk. And you'll notice right away that it is larger than the rest. Now, I can't. Maybe I can. I don't know. The problem with an online Mikro Gedolot, I'm waiting for Koren to produce an online version of the Koren Tanakh. Anybody has any connections to Koren, you can tell them. That's what I am waiting for. But what I want to show you, you can only see in a printed Tanakh. So here's what I'm going to do. Let's see if this will work. Okay. It'll work if I stop using my background video. Please, well, I can't really do that. But can everybody? No, you can't.
You have to stop sharing also, because otherwise you're very tiny.
Okay, so let me stop sharing for one moment. Now, can everybody see this section right here where my finger is moving? Okay, everybody see that? All right, well, I gotta be careful in the view. All right, if you notice, there's a break in the text. Everybody see that there's a little break in the text? Okay.
Yes.
Okay. That's the beginning of chapter 7. Now, why is that important? Because that is the only paragraph break in the whole text. Normally, paragraph breaks break up a section, chapter, subchapter, etc. Out besides the introductory 11 verses that we talked about when in our first class, in the entire book of Qohelet, there's only one paragraph break. And that's the beginning of chapter 7. That is also reflected in that letter that's enlarged more than the others. So from all of those perspectives, there is evidence in the text itself that everything from chapter 7 to the end is a separate theme than chapters 1 through 6. If you divided the book in half, that would be the division. The end of chapter 6, beginning of chapter 7. So from that perspective, we're going to see why that's important for us, but the end of chapter 6 sort of brings to a close some of the themes that we've been addressing from the beginning of the Sefer. That's number one. In number two, we have a very dramatic shift in the style of the speaker from chapter 5, verse 12. Yesh ra'ah chola ra'iti tachat ha-shamash. There is a grievous evil that I have seen under the sun, and whatever his issue is, that's certainly no longer articulated by the Yirei Elokim. The Yirei Elokim, who is the speaker in the first half of chapter 5, is not going to talk about a grievous evil that he has seen under the sun. Right? That's just not the language of the Yirei Elokim. And on top of that chapter, if I go back to the structure overall, that phrase, Yesh ra'ah chola ra'iti, Tachat HaShemesh appears at the beginning of chapter 6 and chapter 5, and again at the beginning of chapter 6. So there's a kind of a link between these two sections. Add to that the subject matter of this unit, and the subject matter he's talking about is Osher, wealth, he's talking about Amal, what benefit is there to toil to the wind? He's talking about wealth. He's talking about toiling. He's talking about losing that wealth, gaining that wealth. He raises the question of a child, an heir, a yoresh, which is a theme that Kohelet's been struggling with from the beginning of the book. So clearly from these vantage points, from perspectives, I think it's a safe bet to say that we have now returned to the world of the builder, the toiler, the Amal, who is responding both to what the Nehenatan back in chapter 3 said. We have to still go back to his world, as well as the Yirei Elokim in chapter 5 and what he was addressing. In addition, other evidence that we have that's kind of this is a closure point for the first half of the book has to do with the fact that if you remember the text opened, let's go back to the beginning, the text opened with a whole description. Remember that secular states of nature that we talked about in terms of what it symbolized for the book itself? We talked about the cycle of generations coming and going and man living and dying, the burial back to the earth, the cycle of the land itself. We talked about the cycle of the sun, the sun rises, the sun sets, it goes back to where it started, what is it gained from it. We talked about the cycle of the wind, going around the world, north, south, and back again to north. Turning around endlessly, and we talked about the river, the water. All the rivers that go into the sea, and the sea is never filled. And we used that as a kind of a metaphor for the cycle of the whole book. If you remember back to our opening couple of classes. And that there is nothing new under the sun, meaning everything is this endless cycle that brings you back to the starting point and doesn't achieve anything. And that's the challenge that Kohelet articulates. And in several places in the book, he'll take that metaphor, come back to it, and see it as a symbol for where we're up to in the text, whether at a conclusion or not. And we see that very clearly in the chapters we have described. For example, if I go back to the end of chapter 6, you can see already some of the references to the cycles that we have encountered. So, for example, in chapter 5, person goes. Prophet, does he have to labor to the wind? So you have that reference to the cycle of the wind that represents nothing of any value. Or you have in chapter 6, in a more dramatic fashion, Gam Shemesh Lo Ra'ahu, he's talking about the stillborn, who never has to suffer through life the way he has, or the way he does or sees it. Gam Shemesh Lo Ra'ahu Lo Yada, he's never seen the sun, whereas the person who's been born and dies has to cycle through the seeing of the sun and what it represents for him. And so there is the reference to the cycle of the sun. You have the cycle of the earth itself. Everything starts and ends in the grave, which again is part of his message in that opening section. That verse in particular was the verse we used to unravel or decipher the riddle of the water, because the water symbolized going into the sea that was never satiated, never filled, is represented here by the appetite that is never satiated. So all of these pieces of the original reference to the cycle that we talked about are in a sense coming to fruition and coming to some kind of recognition that we're back to where we started, which by in itself is cyclical, right? Meaning that the text has brought us back to where the text started. That's not necessarily a good thing, right? If you spend 6 chapters and you end up exactly with the same question you started with, it means you have achieved nothing in 6 chapters, then that's exactly Kohelet's point. That is Mayotel Chacham in Exil. What advantage has wisdom given us over the fool? What have we accomplished in all of this search for meaning? Ultimately, nothing. And that's part of his challenge. So chapter 6 is going to bring us back to some of the earlier points and some of the earlier perspectives, not necessarily in a good way. We're going to see why that is significant. So where are we at? So we basically have the perspective of the Amal that's been evidenced in the themes and in the context and in the negativity and in the pessimism that we've encountered. So he's certainly not the Yirei Elokim, certainly not the Ne'anatan, who had a kind of much more positive view on the world, right? And it was the pessimism was reflected particularly in the view of the Amal. And that's where he's at today. And we're going to now see that this whole section from chapter 2 really through chapter 6 is now very structured. Chapter 2 is a kind of an introduction to all the personalities of Kohelet and what I would call the combined effort of them all. And then we started to break them down. Chapter 3, we saw the Ne'anatan, who saw himself as a guest in God's world, enjoyed the ride, so to speak, benefit from it. God put you here for a reason, to benefit from it, to be the recipient of his goodness. But that means that you ignore the world and all of its challenges. The Amal in chapter 4 was unprepared to accept that we're here to do nothing but accept, but see a world with such injustice in it. And so he embraces the world and says, no, it's on me or us or society to fix it. That was chapter 4. Chapter 5 was the Yirei Elokim, who said, okay, let's understand. There's a role for God, there's a role for man, there's a partnership. We don't have to do everything. Our job is to oved, to work the world, not to amal, not to conquer it. And now we're back to the world of the amal, the end of chapter 5 and chapter 6, to see where all of that brings him. Okay? Does that help put a structure to where we're at in the book? Okay. So let's now jump into what we see. Starting with chapter 5. So actually, let me just go back to this overview for a second The way I'm going to look at this text, and I'm making it small intentionally, the way I'm going to look at this text is we're going to look at this section first. This section is more or less identifies the problem. This section is a potential solution to that problem. I'm going to call it A1 and A2. Then we're going to challenge that solution in B1, and then kind of bring that to a conclusion at the end of the text. So that's our goal. And not all of it today. We have today and next week to work this all through. Let's jump in. There is a grievous evil that I have seen under the sun. Wealth kept by its owner for his own detriment, meaning a person who is building and accomplishing and doing and achieves great wealth. What does he do with that wealth? What do we typically do with money that we earn? We spend it? No. Where do we put that which we achieve, that which we accomplish, that which we build, that which we create? We put it in the bank, we put it in investments, we save it for a rainy day, right? We put it away for the future. And so I take that osher, shamor lebala, and I hold on to it. It's kept by its own owner. But that will be his undoing, lira'ato. Why will that be his undoing? V'yavada osherahu b'inyanva. Because that will cause one day that wealth will perish by some misfortune. It's sitting on a in an investment, and that investment is about to crash. I don't know that it's about to crash, but it is. It's going to, and all my wealth and everything that I've accomplished, and everything that I've built, all goes literally down the drain. And then, v'holid ben, I have a son, ve'en bi'adam u'umah. And there's nothing left in the arsenal and the wealth of the father to provide for his son. The father, going back to that reference, he will end up at the end of his life exactly as he was born. Naked, what's the expression? Naked is the day you were born, with nothing into his name. And he'll have nothing for all of his labor that he can carry, that he can take with him. This is terrible, a terrible evil. All of he should come as he goes. And what profit does he gain with all of his labor to the wind? It'll all get lost, it'll all be destroyed. His days of eating in darkness, the kas and anger, and his illness with katzef and the wrath that he has to suffer, all of that toil, all of that effort, all of that anguish, for what? So that it should all be washed down the tube in some market crash where he has nothing left, some misfortune that will take it all away, and then he'll have nothing left to provide to his son, who he has just fathered. Okay. That's the problem. We'll get to the solution to this problem in a moment. But let's just focus on the problem itself. One thing that's very interesting that emerges from this reference in Pasuk Yud Gimel. What's vexing him? The avada oshrau binyan ra, the riches that he has accomplished will perish by misfortune. And if he's fathered a son, he'll have nothing to give him. Now that for us, especially for the Amal, is not an unfamiliar trope. We've seen him address this question before. In fact, several times. The relationship between his own accomplishments and the next generation. It's particularly important for the Amal. Why? The Netan is not worried by the question of the next generation, because his whole purpose is to be the recipient of God's goodness and bounty and world upon him. So whatever he accomplishes, whatever he eats, whatever he enjoys, God has given him. It's only about him. There's no conversation about a second generation that's of any relevance. Okay, so the Netan is not concerned about a second generation. Elohim for sure doesn't address the question of the second generation as a negative. On the contrary, he sees the whole existence as a continuity. Everything's a continuity. I'm part of a continuity of people, and God is part of the continuity of eternity, and we're partners in this effort. And so the question of to whom am I leaving it is not relevant to the Yirei Elohim, because it's everything. I'm just one piece of a larger puzzle. The Amal, on the other hand, whose primary identity is defined by his need to accomplish, to put his imprimatur in the world, to build, to create, to conquer, whether it be a conquer of the moral justice question raised by the Nenatan, the Dimat HaShukim, the tear of the oppressed, or to conquer in terms of wealth and accomplishments and power, right? That's the Osher. In all cases, there needs to be continuity. And what's challenging Kohelet from the very beginning is the question of eternity, the question of death, the question of what do I do with it? Once I've accomplished it, I'm not here forever. I exist outside of the Garden of Eden. I don't live forever. And so the question of the Ben, the question of the next generation, particularly challenges the Amal. However, we've seen a very dramatic shift in the perspective of the Amal, specifically with regards to this question. Back in chapter 2, when we first introduced ourselves to the Amal, we saw the following phrase. Saneti et kol ani et kol hamal. Let's start from Pasuk Zayin. Saneti et chayim ki walay amasai. Hated life because the work that I do under the sun has no purpose. I learned to despise, to hate my own toil. Why? Because at the end I have to leave it to somebody else. And if I have to leave it to somebody else, what have I accomplished in life? And who knows what that somebody else is going to do with everything I've accomplished. Will he be a wise person or a fool? Whether he'll take it and he'll make something greater of it, or whether he'll destroy it, like Shlomo saw in the potential of his own son, Rechavam, and the rebellion of Yeravam ben Nevat. That was in chapter 2. We next saw the question of the Amal's address to the next generation in chapter 4, right? Chapter 3 was the Nenatan. We're going to skip that for a moment. And chapter 4 was the Amal, the first time we introduced ourselves to the Amal, where he turns to the Nenatan, he turns to the Hedonist, and he says, if you're going to withdraw from responsibility from the world, who's going to take care of all of the oppressed? And the tear of the oppressed that has no one to comfort them, such a world, in such a world, I'd rather not be. I'd rather praise the dead who are already dead than those who are living. And better than both of them is the one who never was. If that's the world of that you've created. And then he says that he would rather have a world in which the effort is to build and create. And he had a problem with motivation. He solved the motivation with community, with two and with three, etc. I'm going to get to Pasukat. Yesh echad ve'en sheni. What if I am building and doing and creating, but I'm alone? There's no one else. En sheni. Gam ben va'achen lo. What if I don't have a child? What if I don't have a brother? What if I don't have anybody else? Ve'en ketz l'chol amalo. Gam eino lo tizba osher. And can never, there's no end to the labor. There's no satisfaction to be able to benefit from it. And for whom am I toiling? To whom am I toiling and doing all of this if there's no one else? And so his conclusion is, maybe the conclusion is that there should be two, or there should be three, or there should be chuta mishulash, or maybe there should be a whole society. Maybe I should be part of a larger group, right? So we had that address in chapter 4. So if I look at Kohelet, if I look at the Amal particularly, and to the question of how does the Amal address the question of for whom is this effort of building and toiling and amassing and creating wealth? For whom? Who's he doing it for? There's a progression in the words of the Amal, and I've charted it out for you here in the next page of the source page. In chapter two, we saw the Amal make the declaration that he was frustrated because that I have to leave it to somebody else. There is no purpose to toiling if I have to leave it to anybody. It's all for me, and yet I can't enjoy it. A little bit of maturity, maturing in chapter four, where he talked about the community and the notion of building for somebody else. And so he said, I'm prepared to leave it to somebody. But what if there's nobody else to leave it to? What if the person I leave it to is gone or destroys it? Then ulamiya. So I'm prepared to leave it to, I'm prepared to look at, right? Remember in chapter four, two, he didn't even call his son by a pronoun, right? He doesn't even call him his son. He says, chapter four, what if I don't have a son? And in chapter five, he's got a different issue. He would love to have a son. Ben. But what if he has nothing left to leave to the son that he has just fathered? So we went from wanting it all for himself and not even wanting to recognize that there's another human being in the world, to an effort to try to create a continuity from one generation to the next, but that in itself is a challenge. Two, the fact that he's willing and he wants to be able to give, but now he has nothing left to give because now it's all gone, right? It's all destroyed. Now, again, right now he's identified a problem. He hasn't identified the solution to this problem, nor has he identified why this is a global problem other than a specific instance, right? Not everybody who invests their money in the stock market finds that it crashes at the end of the day. So we'll have to figure out what he does with that extrapolation on a global scale at the end of this unit. But for now, he's addressed this question, and we've seen this kind of maturity. Now, the maturity the Amal goes through is not arbitrary, it's not random, it's part of the story of the Amal. The Amal started in chapter two, and we talked about Shlomo Amal's own world in that effort. The Amal started in chapter two in a kind of a very egocentric, self-contained world. I'm in the middle. It's all about me. That's the world of the Amal. I have to build. I have to create. I have to do. And then there's nothing left because at the end of my life, I'm gone. In chapter four, he kind of segued into the world of the community, the malchus, the society, the king, and tasted the flavor of what it means to live in a world where there are other people. That was chapter four. Now in chapter five, he's kind of come back to the world of my toil, my effort, my accomplishments, but now I'm no longer alone. Now there's a son, there's the next generation, and there's the question of what continuity, what can I create that can go, that can last, that can move from generation to generation? What if I lose it all and there's nothing left to provide? So that's the first step of this journey, right? This maturity in the attitude towards the son and towards his son is a reflection of his own progression. The individual, I am at the center of the universe, who's now tasted a sense of what it means to be part of its tzibur and has now come back to the world of the individual, but now there's more than just him, right? Now there's another that he's willing to acknowledge and include in that conversation. And that brings us to, right, where he goes from there. So let's go back to our text. Previous evil under the sun, wealth is kept, is preserved, it's built upon. You save it for the future so that you can give it to the next generation. And yet there's always that risk that it'll all be lost before that generation has a chance to take of it. Kashi Arum, as he comes from his mother's womb, naked shall he go as he came. With nothing he can take with him. As he came, so he shall go. What benefit is there that he toils to the wind with toiling in darkness, toiling in hunger, toiling in anger, toiling in illness? All of these efforts, if he can't accomplish it, if he can't hold on to it, if he can't preserve it, what does he benefit from it? So Psukim Yudgimel, Yudalit, Tetvav, and Tetzai. All of this is what I would call the problem. This is how he's defined the challenge. By the way, there's an interesting rabbinic expression that is borrowed from this verse. I don't know how, if you're familiar with the language Chazal used to describe, and it's a very odd language, and unless you know where it comes from, you kind of sit there and wonder, how Chazal and the Gemara refer to a woman's womb. The womb in Chazal is referred to as the kever, the grave. It's an odd moment, okay? It's an odd kind of reference. But the Chazal, when they talk about the laws, for example, of laws of family purity, of menstrual bleeding, they talk about p'tichat hakever, the opening of the grave. And I'll show you just as a quick reference, in there's a Gemara that talks about the process of childbirth, and the Gemara is referring to the laws of Shabbos. Are you allowed to violate Shabbos for a person if they're ill? Yes. If what if they say they don't need, or they say they do need, is the question of pikuach nefesh subjective to the individual state of being? So there, the Gemara says chaya, a woman in childbirth, kozman shakever patuach, as long as the grave, in this case the womb, is open, meaning she's in active labor, then you violate the Shabbos for her and whatever she needs, whether she thinks she needs it or not. Whereas nistama kever, when the childbirth, when the womb is closed, meaning the child, the birth is over, then if she says tshichani, then I need, then the laws of Shabbos change. So interesting phraseology, it has ramifications, right? We'll talk about the notion of being born from the grave and returning to the grave. From dust we come, dust we go, right? We are born out of the, from the womb, and we turn to the earth. So Chazal referred to the womb as a kever, as a grave. And so there's a kind of a triata metim, it's a kind of an image of this moment of the resurrection of the dead when you look at the process of childbirth. It's just a symbolic language that's fascinating in and of itself. Where Chazal got this from is unclear, but I have a suspicion, I would argue, that it actually comes from here. Because Kohelet, and we actually, this is a verse that's very often quoted in eulogies. It's a whole different discussion. But Kasher yetzah mibetan imo arum yeshuv lelechet kishaba. A person comes from the womb and he goes back as he came. There's an analogy, there's a process, there's a cycle of coming from one place and going back to that which he, where he came from. Kol umat sheba ken yelech. So there's that cycle of being born and dying in a kind of an arc of you are born, the expression arum, naked, with nothing to you, no, right, no clothes, no externals, no wealth, and you end up in the grave, says the pasuk, in the same way. Now there's a certain philosophical context for a eulogy that when we talk about the good deeds that a person accomplishes that lasts forever, that's how we apply it in the context of a hesped. But in the context of Kohelet, he's specifically referring to the question of the journey. So if that's the case, if that's the cycle of the wind and of life, afar and ruach are the two parts of the cycle that we talked about, the body and the soul, right? Then what is the purpose of it all? And he's addressing really two fundamental questions. One question is the direct response to the Yirei Elokim. The Yirei Elokim came up with a fascinating idea. He said, Mitukashna Tovet.
I would have loved to have had kids.
How sweet is the slumber of the man who works with the sense that his goal is to just do whatever he can and God will handle the rest. He's part of a continuity, he's part of of an eternity. Right? That was the concept of the Yirei Elokim. It's a partner with God. The Amal rejects that idea, returns us to the world of the Amal, which is toil for the sake of a goal, goal-oriented, not process-oriented. And so he turns them and he says, if it's just for the sake of the journey, you don't accomplish anything. What benefit do you have to toil to nothingness, to toil to the wind? Can you imagine turning to somebody who's worked for an entire day, or day laborer who's worked his entire day, comes to the end of the day to achieve his wages, and you say to him, "Well, you know what? I don't have anything to pay you with, but you worked because it was meaningful and purposeful, and it contributed to the continuity of society. But I'm not paying you your wages because I have nothing to pay you with. He's not going to go back tomorrow." So there's a certain response to the world of the Yirei Elokim, who said, "Just do it anyway." And Kohelet says, "For what purpose?" But more importantly, and I think this is really the much bigger issue for us, which is that Kohelet himself is responding to his own development. Right, that relationship with the ben, that relationship with the child that we talked about at the beginning of the discussion, right? Volid ben ve'en bi'adam u'ma, where his goal is to create and to do and to amass and be able to leave it to somebody, able to give it to his son, right? That's taken us into a very different place than we were back in chapter two. Let me just open up a parenthesis for a second and explain what I'm referring to. The world of Tanakh as a whole, outside of Kohelet, okay, Kohelet is an exception to this. There's a few exceptions, but the world of Tanakh as a whole, for the most part, is the subject matter of Tanakh is the Jewish people as a nation. For the most part, Tanakh does not deal with the question of reward and punishment, righteousness and wickedness on an individual scale. It's certainly post the book of Bereshit, which is an exception. Once we end up in the world of Yaakov and his children and his family and the Jewish people and Sefer Shemot and beyond, right? Everything in Tanakh, when it talks about righteousness and wickedness and reward and punishment, is always on a scale of the Jewish people as a whole, a national scale. Tanakh is the subject of the destiny and the relationship between a nation and God. It's not the subject of the relationship between the individual and God. Rabbinically, Chazal dealt with that piece of it a lot. But for the most part, Tanakh doesn't address the question of the role and the relationship and the reward and the punishment and the destiny of the individual, only of the people of the nation of the kingdom. There are a few exceptions. For example, the book of Job, which we've talked about before, right? In the book of Eov, 37 chapters, Eov spends complaining bitterly in language which is very reminiscent of this piece of Kohelet. We'll talk about that next week, complaining bitterly of his own plight. And in the end of the book, chapter 37, chapter 38, and chapter 39, God says to him, "Stop looking at yourself, take a look at the world." Because that's again the challenge that Tanakh deals with is to say, don't look at yourself. You're part of a bigger picture, right? The mindset of the Yirei Elokim, you're part of a bigger picture. You have to look at the bigger picture. Look at the world. Look at the beauty of the world. Look at the harmony of the world. Look at the world of nature, the world of the trees and the birds and the animals and the fish and this. And like, look how powerful it is. You're a tiny little speck. And ultimately, in the world of Kohelet, sorry, in the world of Eov, the solution to the world of Eov, I'm just going to pull that up for one moment. The solution to the world of when finally God comes to the conclusion of the entire book, and he says, okay, this is what it's all about. The conclusion is, Vashem Shavit Shvut Eov, God returned all the fortunes of Eov and restored to him all that he had taken away from him. When? Soloveitchik builds an entire book, Kol Dodi Dofek, opens with the discussion of the role of the Holocaust, and he builds it based upon this idea that Hashem changed the fortune of Job when he learned to pray for his friends, when he learned to pray for others, when he learned to take himself out of the myopic microscope on himself and learn to be part of a society, of a community. That's the language of Tanakh. It's the language Tanakh speaks. The only exception is Kohelet. Kohelet's constantly searching for the me as the individual. What do I get out of this world? What do I get out of this relationship? And in the one place in the book, in chapter 4, where Kohelet kind of said, okay, well, maybe the solution is to look bigger, to look broader, to look outside the canvas of the individual, to look at the malchus, to look at the kingdom, to look at the society. Right? And that failed, because Shlomo failed in that regard. Right? See, he comes back now to say, okay, so now let's go back to my role, my task, my goal, the Amal says, to achieving, accomplishing my world. But he's now been exposed to the benefit, to the value of expanding his pictures, expanding his role. And so now for the first time, we have a child. We have an acknowledgement that there's a continuity within a family. There's a next generation. I can accomplish something if I'm willing to hand it over, but what if I had nothing left to hand over? And now I'm back to an even greater vexing and a greater frustration because I'm willing to build for somebody else. But the stock market crashed and I lost everything that my house was worth. And suddenly I have nothing left to show for it. And suddenly I started in the grave and I ended in the grave. And now he's even more frustrated than he was before. And he's not going to accept the answer of the Yirei Elokim, which was the process itself builds character. Says Yamal, I'm not looking for a process that builds character. I'm looking for an accomplishment. And so he has no choice. He has to have a solution. So what's the solution? What's the solution? In mass fortune and build and build and build and build and build and save and save and save, and then the market will crash and it'll all be gone. So, what's the solution? There's only one solution left. Benefit from it while you still have it, while you still can. And so we read the next four psukim. Hinei asher ha'iti ani tov. The moment I have tov, I have an alternative vision. I have a solution. What's my solution? Ashiyafeh lechol. Whoops. Sorry about that. V'lishtot. To eat and to drink. V'li'ot tova. And to see the good. V'chol amalo shi'amal tachat ha'shamesh. To see all of the good and the labor that he labors under the sun, the limited amount of years that God will give him. That's his portion.
Gam kol adam asher natanu elokim osher nechasim v'shtito lachom emenu
Every man to whom God has given riches and wealth and has given him the power to eat and consume and to benefit himself from that wealth, to take his portion, to rejoice in his labor. That's a gift from God. For his, he shall not remember his days of life for many years. So what's the solution? It's an ingenious solution, which is, solves all his problems.
Consumerism.
Enjoy it now. Enjoy it now. Solves all his problems. His problems started in chapter 2 because he was concerned that he wouldn't, that he would have to leave it to somebody else. He wouldn't be able to enjoy it. What's the solution now? Enjoy it himself. His problem in chapter 4 was that he would have no one to leave it to. Solution? No problem. Don't leave it to anybody. Just consume it. Finish it. Enjoy it. His problem here is that he'll have a son, and by the time he has a son, by the time he has a continuity, by the time he has a second generation, everything that he's amassed and accomplished will all be gone. So what's the solution? Eat it while you have it. Simple solution. Only one problem. What's the only problem? We've seen this before. We saw exactly this, almost exactly this verse before.
This is the Nehemiah.
Correct. This is exactly, this is almost exactly what the Nehemiah said back in chapter 3. Almost. Not quite the same, but almost. I'll put them side by side. You'll see the difference. Here is the text in chapter 3. The Nehemiah in chapter 3, verse 13. And here is chapter 5. In chapter 3, Gam kol ha'adam she'achal v'shata, person who eats and drinks, v'ra'at tov b'chol ha'malo, and enjoys good in all of his labor. Matata l'kimi, that's a gift from God. Who can bring one to see that which will be after him? You can't know what will come after death. And so, for now, your goal is to enjoy the gift from God. Enjoy what you have. Says the Amal in almost exactly the same language. To eat and to drink. And to see good in all of his toil, that he shall toil under the sun all the days that God has given him. That's a gift from God. He won't remember his days forever. Oh, the two verses are almost identical. I would say if it wasn't for the broader context of this whole chapter, I could even argue maybe this is the Nehenatan speaking and not the Amal. But it doesn't work. And it doesn't work here because of the rest of the chapter. But there's also, in the middle, he inserts this phrase, what's a gift from God? To the Amal, to the Nehenna, the gift from God is that which he eats and drinks. That which God gives us, the food, the drink, the wealth, the achievements, that is a gift from God. In chapter 5, what is a gift from God? Well, what's Matat Elokim? To eat and to drink and to enjoy the benefit of this world? No, because it's not right. What's the benefit? What God has given him are his days. Who has accomplished the wealth of the eating and drinking and that which is available to benefit from during that time? He has. The subtle difference. Very subtle difference, but it makes all the difference in the world. But the Amal has landed exactly where the Nehenatan landed. The Nehenatan's conclusion was, we are like the animals who are in this world to receive God's world that God has given us. And the Amal's perspective is that we are in this world to achieve and to amass and to accomplish and to do and then to enjoy while we have it. It's exactly the same place. Conclusion.
The difference is I think the Nehenatan sees it as a gift from God,
Right.
where the Amal sees it as his own.
That's exactly the difference. That's exactly the difference. But you understand that that is what he's done is he's taken us into a place where he said, this is where the goal is. He's taken us to a conclusion, which is exactly the same conclusion as the Nanatan. His conclusion is to eat and enjoy this world, not to benefit to anybody else, not to bequeath it to anybody else, not right, because there's nobody else to bequeath it to, or because he won't be there for it, or because then the wealth won't be there for it. So, you know what? We have no choice. Consume it now. Okay? That's not a solution. You understand that's not a solution. That doesn't help the Nenatan's argument, for the Amal's argument, for the Amal to turn around and say, well, there's only one conclusion after everything that I've done and said, after everything, or I've navigated the whole philosophy of the Amal, the only conclusion is that since it's all there to do something with, the only thing left to do with it is, okay, take it yourself. That puts you into the same place as the Amal, as the Nenatan. But in a sense, even worse, because
he worked for it. He had to work hard for it.
He had to work hard for it. It's not a gift from God. There's no other perspective. And essentially, he's written himself out of the agenda. If the whole purpose of the quest to understand the world was a quest to understand what I accomplish in this world by my philosophy. My philosophy is I need to build and to create and to do and to have achieved something. And if my conclusion is that there is no lasting conclusion beyond the grave, that it's only the here and now, I have not answered the question with which Kohelet has sought this entire sequence, which is meaning beyond the grave, to understand life in the shadow of death. So this conclusion where he's basically adopted the worldview of the Nanatan is very problematic for us. And it's problematic for Kohelet. He's going to reject it in the next chapter. Right? He's going to reject it right away. A person can be given all these riches and wealth and honor, and he lacks nothing for his desires. What if I don't even get to eat it? What if it's all gone before I get to benefit from it? What if I can't even implement the Nanatan's worldview? And now I'm back to where I started. So now I'm in trouble. So he's going to find himself in a loop. And that loop is going to essentially write him out of the script. And that's where we're going to end up. One more piece of this I want to look at next week, which is the rest of chapter 6. And then I'll kind of do a quick summary of where we're at in the text overall. But that more or less is where the Amal kind of finds himself, forced into his own corner to adapt the worldview of the Nanatan, which is the hedonistic worldview, which will become in the second half of the book the source of all evil. The Nanatan will be replaced by the Russia in the worldview of the rest of the book of Tanakh, of Kohelet. And so this becomes very problematic for himself or as a text, and we will explore the rest of it, how he navigates from this kind of very self-centered world into the end of chapter 6, we will, Bezrat Hashem, look at next week. So with that, I will stop. And if there are any questions, I will take them.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Somebody had a question. My pleasure. Somebody put a question on the chat. Is the origin of eat, drink, be merry for tomorrow we die from here? No, it's actually from Isaiah. It's actually from Yeshayahu, who describes the mindset of the people of Yerushalayim the night before Sanherib was going to breach the walls. And there he uses the perspective of achol v'shato ki machar namut, eat and drink for tomorrow we die. Exact reference in Yeshayahu I can look up for you. I don't have it, but it's in the, but it's actually from Yeshayahu.
Rabbi, I
yeah.
think we have a modern day problem similar to the eat, drink, and be merry in the new thought of individuals, you know, individualism, you know, it's mine, it's, you know, I go after it. And society today, sometimes we forget community and.
No question. That I would say that's exactly the conflict between the mind view, the worldview of the Amal, and the worldview of the Re'eh Elokim. To the Amal, it's all about what I do, what I create, and who's going to benefit from it. And so if it's somebody else or if it's for me, and when, if his conclusion is that it's for me, then that's not a conclusion. And so he's out of the conversation. Whereas the Re'eh Elokim's perspective is not, on the contrary. Do it for greater good. Do it for society as a whole. So yes, I think that is very much a reflection of what's of this tension.
Would the Sefer Kohelet have been different if Shlomo HaMelech had had a good insurance agent?
Insurance didn't exist in those days, but maybe that's why it was invented.
Rabbi?
Yes.
A couple of things. When he says that all the usher can't be stored because it can be taken away, isn't that more of a complaint about God than a complaint about people? In other words, for every bad investment you have far more pestilence, war, hurricanes, tsunamis, and that's that the unstable world, especially in those times, was nature more than it was man. So that's why, and you can't store it because you don't know when the plague of locusts is going to come. When there's going to be a war that originates somewhere, you know, in Mesopotamia or wherever. So that's the complaint against God more than against people. That's one. And the Nehenatan and the Amal isn't working a little bit to have more. One just seems to be like, okay, whatever I get, you know, almost like manna from heaven. I think it's a more, the Amal is here is a more sophisticated person who says, you know what, I can have two beers if for the next week I and save and invest a little bit. Not for the next 20 years, but for the next week.
Let me answer the second question first. Write it down. Park it. Let's come back to it next week because we're not finished. He has to still get to chapter 6, and I think he's going to address that question in chapter 6. As far as your first point goes, I would argue in the world of Tanakh, I don't think they considered natural catastrophes to be God's evil in the world. I think that if you look at the phraseology of the issues that they present in Tanakh, natural challenges are natural challenges, but the evil that man creates or the evil of, you know, when God brings down, the critique of God is always on the domain of righteousness and suffering. But not in the context of natural disasters, but rather in the context of man suffering at the hands of another man or God allowing that to happen. So I'm not sure that that is, that fits a biblical perspective as much as if it's a modern perspective. I have to think about that one.
Okay, that's fair enough. And when you talked about that little page break, you know, isn't that from the Masoretes? In other words, we don't know how the person who wrote it down after Moses or after Solomon organized it. So that's already somebody's idea of where the chapters where things differ and to put it in. It wasn't, unless we can trace it to Solomon.
No, that's I'm not imposed. Suggesting or implying that the chapter that the division is attributed to Shlomo any more than I'm attributing the chapter division to Shlomo. All I'm saying is that it's a reflection of interpretation. Meaning,
yes, there we agree.
But it's a very old, traditional, midrashic interpretation that tells me this is a logical place to look at the context of the content. So the same way I would look at the Mefarshim and try to understand, or the trup, which also is also Masoretic, right?
Yes.
And use that as a way of breaking up the phrases and understanding it. That's part of Torah Shemot Peh. There's no way to understand a text without, by ignoring that, right? That's part, we do that in Chumash all the time. And the rest of Tanakh as well. Paragraph divisions throughout Tanakh are from the Masoretic text, but they're very important. So I would argue that whereas in Tuvim they're less consistent, but they're nonetheless still important.
Okay, thank you.
No problem.
Thank you, Rabbi.
You're welcome, everybody. Have a wonderful week. We'll see you all next week. Please stay safe.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.